This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Hush, hush, sweet Charlotte. Charlotte, don't you cry. The season's almost over. The remaining days will fly. Dry those tears, Charlotte. Tie that untied lace. Play hard and smile, my dear, although you're in last place. Having won fewer games than any other team in the WNBA this summer, the members of the Charlotte Sting will be watching the playoffs on TV, unless they're all somewhere trying to forget basketball entirely. Joining me now to discuss some of the more successful teams in the WNBA as we approach the postseason is Clay Callum, the publisher of Full Court Press. Clay, welcome back to Only a Game.
Well, thanks a lot. It's always great to be here.
At the top of the standings are Connecticut in the East and Sacramento in the West, both leading their conferences by extremely healthy margins. What happened to all that parity we were talking about at this time last year?
Well, it's very interesting. Connecticut has just played extremely well, really taken off. Sacramento is really the surprise team. They came out of nowhere to play as well as they did, but they suffered a very serious blow Thursday night when DeMaya Walker, their leading scorer, looks like she tore her ACL. And Walker is so important to Sacramento. She was undrafted coming out of college, but has turned herself really into an all-star and Sacramento's best player. She led the team in scoring, second in rebounding, second in assists, and is an outstanding defender. Her loss is really critical. She's almost an irreplaceable part for them because she contributes so much in so many different ways. Some players you can replace, they just rebound. You can get somebody to go in there and rebound, but they need someone who can do three or four things to truly replace DeMaya Walker.
In the last 10 days of last year's regular season, Indiana went from first place to last place and missed the playoffs. Can we expect any of that type of drama going in either direction this year?
We are going to have a lot of drama. The last playoff spot in the East is going to be decided most likely between Detroit and Washington, and they play twice in the last 10 days of the season.
Mm-hmm.
So those two games will probably determine which team makes the playoffs and which team doesn't. We have the same kind of drama at the bottom of the standings in the West as three teams, Phoenix, Minnesota, and Los Angeles, battle for one playoff spot.
Well, I want to get to Los Angeles because the Sparks are trying to avoid missing the postseason for the first time since 1998. They had some injuries this year, but I understand that's really just the beginning of their problems.
The injuries really are minor there. The key was Henry Bibby, the recently fired coach, though the Sparks wanted to make sure no one used the word fired, even though he left 10 minutes before they were about to play a game.
But sounds like fired to me.
It certainly looks that way. But Bibby simply couldn't adjust to the WNBA. He had never coached women before. He wasn't familiar with the league. And really, he just lost the team. They have Lisa Leslie and Shamiqua Holzclaw, two of the best players in the world, plus three other starters who were in the All-Star game. And they're three games below 500. Granted, there have been injuries, but hey, in this league and every league, everyone has injuries.
Jellybean Bryant, recently hired as the coach of the Sparks, is not the first NBA celebrity hired to coach in the WNBA. I'm thinking of Muggsy Bogues and Bill Laimbeer, who, of course, was very successful in that role. I wonder whether the league is counting on the celebrity power of its coaches to draw a few more fans into the arenas.
I think to an extent some of the front offices are trying to count on that, but as Henry Bibby, who would qualify as a celebrity coach
absolutely
in LA, shows, it's not always the best move. The WNBA is no different than any other professional league. If you want to draw, you better win. And what you want to do is hire coaches who will win.
In the WNBA short season, peaking at the right time is so important, and New York seems to be doing just that. They go into today's game against Connecticut riding a four-game winning streak. Can we expect good things from the Liberty from here on out?
I would say no, sadly enough, because of another injury to Ann Waters, who broke her wrist against Charlotte, taking a hard foul from Helen Darling, and she's out for the year. Without Waters in the middle, the Liberty really are going to have trouble matching up against Taj McWilliams-Franklin of Connecticut and really anyone with any size. She was the best center in the East, if you consider Taj McWilliams-Franklin a forward, And losing her is just a crippling blow for the Liberty, just as losing DeMaio Walker would be a crippling blow for the Monarchs.
All right, Clay, the time has rolled around for what we've all been waiting for, and I have to ask you for your pick for 2005 WNBA champion.
Well, as Bruce Jenkins, the San Francisco Chronicle sports writer, says, it's time to join the Dead Wrong in Public Club.
Well, you're a part of a great tradition on this program, if that's the way you choose to go.
Well, you have to feel that Connecticut is the team to beat. They've shown that they can handle everyone. They have all of the pieces. Mike Thibault is a brilliant coach. Lindsey Whalen is a tremendous leader. Nikesha Sales is one of the most talented athletes in the league. Taj McWilliams Franklin is having maybe her best season in a distinguished career. So the Sun have to be the heavy favorites. I think the teams that conceivably could surprise would be Detroit. If the Shock make the playoffs with the addition of Katie Smith, they start a very impressive lineup. And the other team to watch out for is the Houston Comets, who added Dawn Staley from Charlotte. And with Dawn Staley, Cheryl Swoops, Tina Thompson, Jeanette Arcane, they have four Olympians in their starting five, plus 6'5 Michelle Snow. With Sacramento's loss of Walker, I think Houston is the team most likely to come out of the West, and Houston-Connecticut final could be a very interesting series.
Clay Callum is the publisher of Full Court Press. Clay, thank you very much for joining me.
It's always a pleasure.
In the 1920s and 30s, almost a third of all professional boxers in America were Jewish. The last Jewish world champion was Mike Rossman, who held the light heavyweight crown in the late 1970s. 23-year-old Orthodox Jew Dmitry Salita could be next. John Kalish profiles the undefeated junior welterweight from Brooklyn with the Star of David on his trunks.
Dmitry Salita came to America as a 9-year-old boy. His family left the Ukraine in search of a better life and settled in a neighborhood not far from the huge expatriate Russian community in the Brighton Beach section of Brooklyn.
It wasn't easy. I mean, you don't speak English, you don't wear clothes that's called cool or hip. And, you know, kids pick on you, kids make fun of the way you speak and the way you dress. When kids used to pick on me, I used to get into a lot of fights because I wouldn't take anything, you know. But, you know, bit by bit, I learned. My English got better. I adjusted to the culture. And, you know, some of the kids that I fought with became friends. And I think most people have to go through the initiation process, so to say.
When Salita was 13 years old, he took up boxing at a massive Brooklyn housing project called Starrett City.
One of the great things about the Starrett City Boxing Club is kind of it's a micro society of New York City, the melting pot. And there are people there from all different walks of life, training and working together. And for the period of time that they're in the gym, they're all the same and they're all helping each other out or, you know, trying to accomplish a similar goal.
Salita says the hip-hop soundtrack at the Starrett City Boxing Club had a profound effect on his rhythm in the ring. Jimmy O'Farrow, the club's founder, says Salita boxes black.
When I took him out to box, everywhere we went, all over the country, he didn't fight no white boys, he fought all black boys, all Spanish boys. So when he got in the ring, and these black boys said, I'm going to kick that white boy's butt. And then after the first round, they said, oh, hell, we're in trouble. Because they found out that he got the moves, the slips, the slides. I didn't know how to get out of the way, you know how to get in. No, he don't fight like an average white boy does.
After Salita started boxing, his mother succumbed to cancer. Before she died, he met a Hasidic Jew in her hospital room who argued with him that boxing wasn't an appropriate career for a young Jewish man. The encounter ultimately started Salita on the path of religious observance. Today, he keeps kosher, strictly observes the Jewish Sabbath, and prays every day. He won't fight on the Sabbath or scores of other Jewish holidays. His rabbi is Zalman Lieberhoff, who's with the Lubavitcher Hasidim.
He understands that even in such a sport, you can serve God. So we're taking over here in a way we're bringing heaven down to earth. I mean, Dmitry agrees that the ring is not heaven, right? It's earth. Okay, but when he comes into the ring, it's heaven.
Salita's boxing matches draw religious Jews in awe of a successful Jewish athlete who keeps the Sabbath. When he enters the ring, it is sometimes to the accompaniment of a song by the Hasidic rapper Matisyahu or to a live klezmer band. Salita's professional record stands at 22-0. Boxing observers praise his left jab and hand speed, but say he's lacking for power. Although Salida is viewed as a promising prospect, he's not yet considered a world-class boxer. Among the formidable opponents Salida has to face down the road is another Brooklyn boxer, Paul Malignaggi, who's considered faster and a harder hitter than Salida. Malignaggi's ring antics and over-the-top persona are the antithesis of Salida's soft-spoken, polite demeanor. Thomas Hauser is a boxing writer who's followed Salida's career.
Paulie and Dimitri, in one sense, would be a natural fight because they're both from New York and they both have their own individual constituencies. It would be a real throwback fight to the days when you had the Jewish fight clubs and the Irish fight clubs and the Italian fight clubs, and when the guys from the clubs fought each other. You had great barn burner fights. But at this stage, I just don't think Dimitri is ready for Paulie. Dimitri's got to step up the level of opposition and see what he's made of.
Salida thinks he's made of the stuff of champions.
If I wouldn't feel that I can accomplish the things that I wanted to accomplish, I wouldn't box, because I don't want to be average and I don't want to stop halfway. I want to, God willing, you know, accomplish the goals that I've set for myself. And, you know, you got to set the bar as high as it can go.
Salida's original trainer, Jimmy O'Farro, is convinced the Jewish fighter has a bright future.
He's got things inside of him. They don't even know. They don't know what's inside this kid. I do. He's going to knock people out, but not now. In another year, he's going to knock people out. He's learning how to punch straight, hard now. It's been inside his system all this time. Now they're going to bring it out. That's what's coming. He doesn't even know that.
Dimitri Salida will fight for the North American Boxing Association junior welterweight title on Thursday at the Hammerstein Ballroom in Manhattan.
The winner, by way of unanimous decision.
For Only a Game, I'm John Kalish in New York.
Dimitri Salida!
It's 19 minutes. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, bowling, extraterrestrials, and various other of our customary concerns. But first, after 21 years, National Hockey League games will no longer be broadcast by ESPN. The All Sports Network opted not to match a three-year, $200 million deal from Comcast. The cable colossus will air two games a week on the outfit previously known as the Outdoor Life Network, now simply OLN, where other features include Tour de France coverage, hunting and fishing programs, and Survivor reruns. Joining me now on the line is Richard Sandomir, who covers sports, business, and media for the New York Times. Richard, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you, Bill.
Let's talk finances first. Is it fair to say the National Hockey League has landed a more lucrative deal than any rational person might have expected?
Yes. There was no belief in my mind that they could get what they hoped for. And I thought that the National Hockey League had absolutely no leverage whatsoever. I told Gary Bettman yesterday that he proved me to be a liar.
Spokespeople for Comcast and OLN say that NHL fans will have no trouble finding the games on TV. Are they right?
Well, as long as they have OLN. OLN has 64 million subscribers right now. ESPN has 90 million, so there is a discrepancy there. They hope that the NHL will drive subscribership higher, but the fact remains that there will be a time lag between when everybody will have OLN as accessible as ESPN. It could be a few years. There are going to be people disenfranchised by this. Gary Bettman does not think that's a huge problem. He remembers when ESPN and ESPN2 had 25, 30, or 40 million subscribers, but that was a long time ago, and here you are taking something away in terms of National Hockey League games that people took for granted on ESPN. 10% of those people who have OLN get it on digital, and some subset of that get it as a digital sports offering, which creates one problem for that small subset. In those markets, they will not be able to get their local team. It's some bizarre little blackout policy that if you get OLN as a digital sports offering, like here in Long Island and New York, those who are Cablevision subscribers, they won't be able to get Rangers, Islanders, or Devils games.
OLN is still a channel that caters to a niche market, or perhaps a few different niche markets. The NHL has been relegated to niche status on the sports landscape by many people. Perhaps the two were made for each other.
Perhaps that is true. You know, I think OLN is in a position, as Bettman says, to make hockey a priority, whereas in on ESPN, it had gotten marginalized. Its prime day had been moved to accommodate the National Basketball Association games a couple of years ago. So Bettman and the league had every reason to feel like it was a child that wasn't much regarded. So here they have OLN, whose biggest thing is the Tour de France, which is only a three-week thing, and now the Tour de France gets diminished to some degree because Lance Armstrong will not be riding it anymore, and it's a way for OLN to get more attention for itself. Myself, I don't see how it gets much more subscribership based purely on having the NHL. The NHL may not get much higher ratings than bull riding does.
Neither ESPN nor Fox could make a winner of pro hockey on TV. How does Comcast think that it can succeed where those networks have failed?
I don't know. You know, Fox, because they heavily promoted it and it was only the second of their sports when they started up, they made it a priority, and they had the glowing puck, which turned off aficionados and the core fans, but that wasn't for core fans. Their ratings were pretty darn good, considering what the NHL is. The league itself, with the neutral zone trap, had become a boring league. They needed rules changes. They've been hurt by the fact that since the Rangers won the Stanley Cup in 94, there's been weakness in all three of the major markets. The Blackhawks, the Rangers, and the Kings have not done well. And a league can't really survive as well as they could if the Rangers continued to be a good team, which seems to be an impossibility here in New York.
Richard, what's the public reaction likely to be now OLN can say, we have acquired the National Hockey League? Does the public say, wow, that channel's really a player now? Or does the public say, wow, that channel's an idiot?
A lot will say, where is OLN? This isn't exactly like, you know, football going in 1994 from CBS to Fox. I know where it is because I watch, I get paid to watch, but I watch the Tour de France every year. But, you know, it's a, people are going to be first, you know, maybe tell, you know, think of it as a little bit of a joke that the Outdoor Life Network has an indoor sport. But I think in anticipation of hopefully getting the NHL, they changed their name to OLN. So they took the leaf out of their logo, and now it's a generic network. And 5 years from now, some people won't even know what OLN used to stand for any more than they might remember what ESPN used to stand for.
Finally, let's talk about this new deal from ESPN's standpoint. ESPN made the decision to drop hockey. Does this constitute a general shift in the network's policy, or was it simply a decision that resulted from doing the math?
You know, the math was made easier by the fact that the league was in a lockout the last season, and they saw that other things could rate higher. Their dramatic series tilt, college basketball games would rate higher, sometimes two and three times higher than hockey. So it became sort of a laboratory to prove that they could live without hockey. Now, these things go around in circles, and there's always an extra bidder out there, it seems, popping up, like Fox did for football, to raise the value of sports rights. Just when you think sports rights are going to go down, they go up. Just when you thought hockey was going to be worth zero to a cable channel, it's worth now an average of $70 million a year. You just never know.
Richard Sandomir covers sports business and media for the New York Times. Richard, thank you very much for speaking with me.
My pleasure.
It was hard to ignore the email.
We are getting together on Saturday at 6 p.m. in Boston to play bowling.
It read,
there'll be a chance for exchange and a question and answer period also for those who have questions. Raelian philosophy will replace all major religions in this third millennium.
Raelians, for those who don't know, are followers of the French journalist Claude Vorilon, a.k.a. Rael. Their religion holds that life on Earth was created by extraterrestrials called Elohim. Perhaps at this point you're thinking what only a game Sean Cole was thinking when he received the email. That's absurd. They can't be serious. I mean, really? Bowling?
I walked into Boston Bowl, your standard bowling alley arcade a few minutes from downtown, knowing a thing or two about the Raelians. I knew that one of their missions was to create an embassy on Earth for the Elohim, so that we might reunite with our creators. I knew that a Raelian scientist had claimed to have generated the world's first human clone in 2002. I knew that they had chapters all over the world, that they'd only been in Massachusetts for a couple of years, and I knew what the head of the Massachusetts chapter, Mehran Sam, looked like, because I'd seen him on TV.
Hey, how are you doing? Good to see you.
What I hadn't known was that the Raelians bold.
No, we are we're down-to-earth guys. We are people like everybody else. As I said, we are from all walks of life. We have our own full-time jobs, and we are active members of the society, and we like to have fun, and we do all the normal things that other people do, too.
Mehran is from Iran. He's a biologist with a PhD from the University of Toronto. He wasn't wearing a spacesuit, had regular clothes, regular hair. In fact, the only way you would have known he was a Raelian was by the silver medallion around his neck, a Star of David with a whirlpool in the middle.
This symbol is the symbol of infinity, is the symbol of Elohim. You can see it in India, you can see it in South America, you can see it in so many different cultures that did not have any interaction with each other because it's come from them, from our scientific creators, the Elohim.
Two other fairly normal-looking children of the Elohim showed up around the same time I did, a married couple named Cassio and Albie. Mehran asked me not to interview them, or anyone else at the event that night, except him. So we sat, waiting for the rest of the uninterviewable bowling Raelians to arrive. They did not. I kept the conversation with Mehran going as best I could while we were waiting, but it wasn't easy. I mean, what do you ask the head of the Massachusetts Raelian movement in this situation?
So do you prefer candle pin or 10-pin bowl?
I play both. I guess the candle, maybe. It doesn't really matter. They're both fun. As long as you have fun, that's the main deal.
This is actually a key precept in Raelian thinking, that people are born to experience pleasure and that you can't bring happiness to others if you're not happy yourself. To this end, the prophet Rael espouses sexual permissiveness, sensual meditation, nudity, and sports.
We say that playing games is a lot of fun, and it's important that we do play games. The people who are very serious all the time and they take everything so seriously, they are also not healthy. They don't have the...
Mehran explained a lot about Raelian philosophy that night, which is surprisingly similar to more mainstream religions. Elohim, for example, is a Hebrew word, but Mehran said it was mistranslated in the Bible to mean God. It really means those who came from the sky, he said, i.e. outer space.
And it was Elohim who sent the prophets, like Jesus, Moses, Buddha, Muhammad, all these prophets were sent by them to guide humanity to the age of science and technology we are now in.
But when we bombed Hiroshima 60 years ago this month, the Elohim realized that we had now advanced to the point where we could destroy ourselves and that they'd better send another prophet down here. So in December 1945, Rael was conceived.
Rael's mother is a human being from Earth, but his father is Yahweh, who is the president of the Elohim.
If this part sounds familiar, it's because, according to the story, the Virgin Mary was also impregnated by the Elohim 2,000 years ago.
So Rael is, in fact, the brother of Jesus.
I never thought I'd be having this conversation in a bowling alley.
It's great, huh? Life is full of surprises.
And it was about to get fuller. When it was clear that no one else was coming, Mehran, Cassio, and Albie asked me to bowl with them. I told them I hadn't planned on it, that I should probably just watch, but they insisted. There's only three of us, they said, and we need a fourth. Of course, when we got to our assigned lane, we learned that each player's score is tabulated individually on a computer console. They didn't need a fourth player at all. But it was too late. I already had my funny shoes on.
So, Mehran's winning so far.
Oh,
am I?
Oh, now it's a religious thing.
This is Albie. As it turns out, he's not a Raelian at all, just a lapsed Catholic who's married to one. He's also a pretty good play-by-play announcer, offering to call the game whenever it was my turn.
He's confronting the lane. He's shooting. Got a ball.
No, I'm embarrassing myself.
No, it's beautiful.
No, it's not beautiful at all.
It is, though. It's fun.
His wife, Cassio, was doing a lot better than me at first, too.
Nice, nice strike. Watch this.
Oh my God. Cassio downs 8 pins on her second turn.
Though later, she accidentally threw herself onto the floor, which isn't nearly as embarrassing as my ripping off half my thumbnail in one of the smooth, edgeless finger holes. I'm not sure what I was expecting. People with quilted shoulder pads psychically manipulating the ball as it levitated 3 inches off the parquet floor. I'm not sure what I was expecting, but it was nothing this ordinary. I'm sure everyone around us figured we were just another group of friends having fun on a Saturday night. If the Raelians really want people to believe that they're just like everybody else, they've hit upon a great way to do it. And they seem to know that. Believe it or not, when Mehran first contacted the Raelians, back when he was a graduate student in Toronto, they invited him to go bowling.
The first time that I called them, they said, okay, we are going bowling like in next week. So me and my friend, we went there in that bowling alley in Toronto. There were like four or five other Raelians. They all had this symbol on their neck. And we met them and we saw they're very normal people. They're happy, they're laughing, they're joking around. And I said, these are great. And they invited me to their next lecture. And from then on, I've been part of the movement and I decided to help Rael.
Were they good bowlers?
Not really. We are just average. Some of us are good, but I'm average, if not below.
I don't know if modesty is a typically Raelian trait, but Mehran has it in spades. After pulling away from the pack early on, nothing about his game fell under the definition of average.
Oh, look at him now.
Oh, my God.
Oh!
Strike for Mehran. Very good.
Thank you.
Especially not compared to me.
We're back at Candlepins Live for Cash, and here's Sean. He's setting it up. He's throwing it backwards. He shoots again. It's a blistering gutter ball.
In the end, Mehran whipped everyone, earning 96 points compared to Albie's 79 and my 69. Cassio was last at 54. Still, if the point of the evening was to have fun, we definitely did. The prophet Rael would have been proud. Except that bowling isn't really his sport of choice. Before learning he'd been conceived by extraterrestrials in order to deliver their message to humanity, he had dreamed of becoming a Formula One racing champion. For Only a Game, I'm Sean Cole in Boston.
Oh, there she goes. That's going to be a strike.
You're listening to Only a Game. Last week's program included a story by Steve Goldstein about the air-conditioned golf carts in use on courses in Phoenix, Arizona this summer. The report drew some spirited email. Oh, geez, wrote Samadhi Eberstad, how about a piece on the environmental effects of golf courses, water use, chemical runoff, etc.? Greg Morrill, who hears Only a Game on WFCR in Amherst, Massachusetts, was similarly moved by the story. Golf, golfers, and people who watch golf got what they deserved from your recent report on air-conditioned golf carts, he wrote. Humiliation! Golf is a game that should only be played in Scotland by drunken men over 70 in baggy knickers and caps. Karen Givens' report on the out games earned praise from Anna Rubin, who hears the program on WYPR in Baltimore. Thanks for a great story and the intelligent reporting, she wrote. Ms. Rubin's opinion was not shared by Henry Spencer, who hears the program on WLRN in Miami. Because I know there are children listening, I can't quote from Mr. Spencer's email. Our story on the NCAA's recent decision to ban from its postseason tournaments Indian mascots inspired Patrick Mackin, who hears Only a Game on WCPN in Cleveland, to reply. Mr. Mackin cited a 2002 survey that demonstrated that over 80% of Indians polled had no objection to colleges and pro teams using Indian nicknames and mascots, and he quoted from a Sports Illustrated article that maintained that there is, quote, a near-total disconnect between Indian activists and the rank-and-file Native American population on this issue. Mr. Mackin closed his letter with a story about a trip that he had made to Jacobs Field to see a World Series game in 1997. One of some 20 Indian protesters looked at my chief Wahoo jacket and yelled at me that I was a racist. I yelled back that he was an idiot, and then I went on to the game. Bill, you're certainly not an idiot, and I love the show, but on this issue, you were way off base. Should you wish to respond to something you've heard on the show, write us at Only a Game, WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. You can reach us through our website, onlyagame.org. Our email address is onlyagame@wbur.bu.edu. Or you can leave a comment on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860. Thank you. 22.5 minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston. Additional support comes from Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Available at the Implant Dentistry Center at Bicon.com, BICON.com. And from the dairy farm families who own Cabot Creamery, 5 generations of farming and making naturally aged cheddar cheese in Vermont, on the web at CabotCheese.com.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, we contemplate some of the world's more determined and bizarre record setters. But first, I'm joined by our analyst, Charlie Pierce, for a discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
We established last week that I have not attended enough pro football training camps, but if I did attend one, it would be the Minnesota Vikings camp. Guess why?
Because Mike Tice, last seen confessing that he had sold his Super Bowl tickets for slightly more than face value, has turned into Mr. Happy Fun Guy.
That's right.
Inviting people from the sidelines to join the drills,
hey,
as long as they were wearing Vikings jerseys.
You number three, get in here.
Yeah, apparently this guy, Mike Henniger, went to training camp wearing a jersey that said number three, and the coach waved him into a walkthrough drill where nobody really hits anybody.
A good thing.
But at which point he replaced another guy named Adam Goldberg, who had been working there, who Tice playfully threw out of practice.
There you go. By the time the college football season opens, Oklahoma State may not have enough players to field a team. Coach Mike Gundy has tossed 9 guys off the team since taking over the job in January. Would you please tell us about Coach Gundy's rules and then perhaps comment on their fairness?
Well, you can get thrown off for low grades, failure to meet team requirements, and off-the-field issues. I don't know what off-the-field issues are, but presumably they have something to do with not going to class and not meeting team requirements.
In college, after you've thrown 9 guys off the team, how many do you have left?
104.
I was thinking he'd still be okay. On Wednesday, Jim Calhoun, the coach of the men's basketball team at the University of Connecticut, announced that 2 members of that team had been suspended. This was probably a sound move, given that it's hard to get up and down the court in leg irons.
Well, as we know, Bill, if it wasn't for the stupidity of American criminals, this would be a much more dangerous country in which to live. These are 2 important players, not that that matters. Marcus Williams managed to steal laptops from members of the Connecticut women's team, not exactly a low-profile organization, and then tried to pawn them in Manchester, where everybody knows who he is. Also charged in the theft was A.J. Price, who last year was one of your classic nice feel-good stories on all your telecasts of your Connecticut games because he'd had a brain hemorrhage and he'd missed the season. Marcus Williams had missed most of 03-04 because of academic problems. The spotlight that's on the Connecticut team isn't always a good thing, and Jim Calhoun, a month away from being inducted into the Basketball Hall of Fame, has some splaining to do.
Elsewhere in college basketball, the NCAA has bought the national invitation tournaments for more than $40 million. I guess the only way to prove you're not a monopoly is to just buy your competition.
This $40.5 million price tag pretty much concludes that the NCAA thought it was going to lose the ongoing litigation because it really was acting like a monopoly. So basically, it did what monopoly players do from Donald Trump to the little shoe in the game. It buys up all the competitions.
Charlie, people will remember the PGA Championship, which ended on Monday morning as Phil Mickelson's second win in a major. But if Mickelson and 2 other golfers had bogeyed the 18th hole on Sunday, that tournament might have gone down in history for quite a different reason,
yes,
right?
Yes, it could have had the corporate jet equivalent of the old movie Dawn Patrol because Tiger Woods was already on his way home to Florida.
And he could have been in
I do wish we'd seen the spectacle of him having to turn the Gulf Stream around and land, tying his golf shoes as he comes down the steps and hopping into the limo to finish the playoff.
When National Hockey League play resumes, you will no longer be able to watch games on ESPN. Does the NHL's new deal with Comcast constitute a step down for the NHL or just the greatest swindle ever pulled off by a pro sports league?
Well, you can make the latter point if anybody pays them 45 cents to put their games on TV. But, they're moving from ESPN and ESPN2 to what is now called OLN, which is not the Outdoor Life Network anymore. That's going from approximately 179 million homes to 63 million homes. OLN is making a big pitch to become a rival to ESPN, and quite frankly, OLN, as we know, as those of us who watch the Tour de France knows, is very good at televising stuff. If they can put the same kind of quality control into their NHL telecasts as they put in their Tour de France coverage or their America's Cup coverage or their coverage of the All-Star Barbecue Showdown, then hockey fans may well be happy with it.
This week, the Phoenix Suns Gorilla and the Philadelphia Phillies Fanatic were delighted to learn that they had been selected for induction to the Mascot Hall of Fame, and so I guess we should send our condolences to the short-lived San Francisco Giants Crazy Crab and, of course, to Hupie, formerly of the former Montreal Expos.
I think Yuppie's going to have to wait for the Veterans Committee to get in because I don't think enough people in the electorate remember him. Of course, the Fanatic joined the famous Chicken and the Phoenix Suns Gorilla as charter members of the Mascot Hall of Fame.
Why is there a Mascot Hall of Fame?
Why is there a Baseball Hall of Fame? I have no idea.
Turning to baseball,
and
Rafael
Halls of Fame.
Palmeiro said this week, quote, "My day will come when I can say what happened." Does this sound to you like he's trolling for a book deal?
It sounds like he's trolling for a deal with Acuff Rose and a Country and Western album. His day will come, and he will say what happened, and he will get a lovely advance for it, I'm sure.
Negotiations between the Washington Nationals fan and Nats pitcher Levon Hernandez have apparently broken down. The fan caught the glove that Hernandez tossed into the stands after he was removed from a game on August 5th and then told Hernandez that he would give the glove back in return for season tickets, playoff tickets, and $18,000. Sound like a fair trade?
You got to love the $18,000, by the way. He wants season tickets. He's telling them he's going to make the playoffs, but just in case, he wants the $18,000. Do we know what happened to the cap and jacket that Hernandez also threw into the stands, or are they just not of paramount importance?
Well, presumably separate negotiations are underway even as we speak. Heartlessly, the New York Mets have banned a former groundskeeper from Shea Stadium, Dominic, a.k.a. Pepsi Velilla. The groundskeeper has said the whole thing doesn't seem fair. Is he right?
No. Pepsi Velilla was part of a $360 million organized crime gambling ring run by the Bananos. Baseball's sort of sensitive about that stuff. I'm sorry, Pepsi. You're going to have to watch it on TV for a while.
Finally, Charlie, scientists at Graz University have determined that yodeling is better than yoga or jogging in terms of easing tension and stress, as well as giving lungs a healthy workout. It's so healthy, in fact, that an online yodeling course is being offered for those who do not happen to live in Graz. So, can I sign you up? Your coursework begins right away for your certificate in yodelology.
First of all, I distrust the bona fides of this study because I think if you had a university in New Delhi, they would find that yoga is more healthy than yodeling or jogging. And in, say, the University of California, Santa Cruz, they'd discover that jogging is more healthy than yodeling or yoga.
Charlie Pierce, skeptic, writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine and joins me at this time each week here on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
I on a hill was a lonely goat herd, lee, oh, lee, oh, lee.
So you're so healthy. I can see.
If I could only learn to yodel.
Lots of youngsters grow up idolizing sports stars, perhaps hoping to become the next Michael Jordan, Mia Hamm, Tom Brady, or Serena Williams. Stephen Church grew up idolizing stars of a different universe, various people who had distinguished themselves by earning places in the Guinness Book of World Records. Now he's written a memoir entitled The Guinness Book of Me, one function of which is to commemorate his former passion. Stephen Church joins me now in the studio. Welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks for having me.
Let me say from the start that I don't want to give our listeners the impression that your book is only a kind of homage to the Guinness record holders, because there's a great deal more to the book than that. Still, what led you to feature such characters as the world's heaviest twins and the man with the longest fingernails in a memoir?
I think the Guinness books were books that I latched onto at an early age. During my adolescence, really, I was a kid who was sort of freakish at that age. I was a big kid, bigger than most of the other kids in my class, bigger than many of my teachers. And so for me, the Guinness books were, or the people in the Guinness books were sort of natural heroes for me. I was 5'7", 160 pounds in fifth grade, and so I felt rather freakish. And I think a lot of people do in adolescence, and I think, you know, that's a lot of why people latch on to some of these Guinness characters. You know, the world's heaviest twins, I still remember the pictures of them on their motorcycles, and they're fascinating characters if you kind of get into some of the stories behind them. And so I found that thinking about these Guinness characters allowed me to understand a little bit more about myself and my adolescence.
Of Jay Gwaltney, a young man who got into the Guinness Book by eating a tree, you write, quote, "I suspect Jay understood the immortality of the page, the legacy of living in a book so full of heroes and freaks." So did you identify with Mr. Gwaltney?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, here's a guy who ate an 11-foot birch tree. And, you know, I'm not saying I would eat an 11-foot birch tree, but the idea that you could do something like that and achieve a world record for that, you know, that's a different sort of heroism, I guess. And I think it was the kind of hero that I needed and maybe other people need. So he was definitely an interesting character for me. And I find myself eternally fascinated, not just with, you know, sort of why you would eat an 11-foot tree, but exactly how would you do that? How would you eat a tree exactly?
Your support system. Did mom and dad cheer you on?
Right, yeah. Did mom, you know, mix it into pies for you? Did dad grind it into sawdust? Did she bake cakes? How exactly does that happen?
Another Guinness record holder you mention is Aaron Marshall, who set the record for longest continuous shower. And of him you write, "Aaron Marshall must have been a little nuts. I mean, who showers for 14 days without having a few screws loose?" Was the nuttiness part of the attraction for you as a kid?
Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, a guy like Aaron Marshall is somebody who's taken some kind of internal demon or insecurity or something and turned it into something sort of magical or heroic or world record worthy. I mean, you have to wonder, did he get into the shower knowing he would be in the Guinness Book of World Records? Did he set out to break a record, or was he just taking a really long shower and decided to stick around for a while? So, yeah, I think that the oddity of it was definitely something that attracted me. The idea that you know, maybe I could do something like this, not necessarily shower or eat a tree, but that I could sort of turn some of my own insecurities or internal demons, some of my own freakishness into something world record worthy.
Well, this is allegedly a program concerned with sports, so we probably ought to mention at least one sort of sports-related Guinness record. Michael Barbon jumped 105,338 times on a pogo stick over the course of 18 hours. This was back in 1978. Do you have any idea whether that record stands?
Actually, it doesn't stand. I believe it doesn't. There's a guy named Ashrita Furman who currently holds the Guinness record for the most Guinness records, and most of his records are actually pogo stick records. So I think he actually
didn't eat one, did he?
No, I don't think he ate one, although I wouldn't be surprised. The guy is kind of an attention hog as far as I'm concerned. But somebody like Michael Barbon, one of the things I liked about him was there's a picture of him in the book, and it's just a kid. You know, he's like a teenage boy. He's in a parking lot outside of what looks like a apartment complex, and he's on his pogo stick. And once again, that idea that, well, geez, maybe I could do that if I really wanted to.
You write that when you were growing up, Steve, your brother's achievements, which were many and varied, made you yearn to be the best at something. Did that desire and the connection to the Guinness Book ever lead you to try to set some arcane record?
You know, I actually never really tried to set a record. What I've discovered is that I was more obsessed with the people, more obsessed with the stories behind the records. Now, actually, recently I submitted a record proposal to the Guinness World Records Organization, which is quite easy to do now, and I proposed to eat a copy of the 2005 anniversary edition of the Guinness Book. They turned me down.
I'm happy to hear it, because your health might have been compromised. You do write that you became attached to some of the Guinness record holders, quote, because of the stories they tell, as you say. But you have to imagine a lot of the backstories of these people, and you do that throughout the book. Maybe the obese twins and the tree eaters and the others were the characters who encouraged you to become a writer so that you could flesh out the very short entries in the actual record book.
Yeah, I think that was a big part of it. I mean, it was like I said, these questions just pop up naturally as to why or how, and it encouraged me to pursue my imagination. And what I discovered as I was going back and trying to write about my childhood and my adolescence and my relationship with my brother and my dad, who were both these sort of kind of hero freak characters to me, is that by writing about the Guinness people and imagining these lives for them, I began to understand something more about myself and my relationship to my brother, who, as you said, was very accomplished in everything that he did. You know, he didn't seem to need sports like I did. He just did it because it was fun. For me, I needed it as some sort of escape or some sort of sense of security. So, yeah, I think that it did allow me to pursue my imagination and did help lead to becoming a writer. And I really indulge in that with the record holders and fictionalize lives for them and sort of imagine these scenarios that, you know, probably never happen. But for me, they are very real and very true, at least in my own mind.
I love your imagining that the gigantic obese twins on their tiny motorcycles probably had arguments with each other about what they should be wearing and things
like that. You know, I mean, when you see pictures of them, they're often dressed the same, and I couldn't help but think, well, you know, who agrees on that? Who decided that they would both wear the checkered pants and the cowboy hat? And those guys are really interesting. They had a sponsorship deal actually with Honda that provided their mini bikes, and they traveled around the country performing in these stunt shows, and I imagine myself at one of these stunt shows and what it must have been like. And what exactly would 700-pound twins do in a stunt show? I mean, how much could they really do on mini bikes?
You know, it strikes me that the record holders you admired and wondered about may have been the reality TV stars of your youth, the precursors of the folks who eat bugs and lie down in coffins filled with snakes on television. Or am I being unfair to the heroes of your childhood?
No, actually, I think that's true. I mean, the difference, though, is that, you know, in the 70s and 80s when I was growing up, they didn't have that outlet. So you have to think that they must have been doing it for some other reason. I mean, there's a certain amount of fame involved in that. They were in the Guinness books. People like me were obsessed with them. They were heroes to some kids, but they weren't on television. They didn't have the sponsorship deals. You know, now they have an International Federation of Competitive Eating, which sponsors these contests, and it was sponsored by Alka-Seltzer, and people have endorsed
it. That's good. I like that.
Isn't that?
See, if it's going to happen, it might as well be sponsored by a product that's going to make you feel better after you destroy yourself.
Yeah, and I mean, they're no less freakish really today, but their fame is more a sort of socially accepted form of fame now. These kinds of folks on the reality TV shows or on ESPN or whatever, they're making money. They're on television. They have that sort of fame. Whereas in the 80s, they were lucky if they made it into the Guinness books and some strange kid like me became obsessed with them. So it was a different sort of fame.
Stephen Church is the author of The Guinness Book of Me, subtitled A Memoir of Record, published by Simon & Schuster. Stephen, thank you very much for joining me here at Only a Game.
Thanks for having me, Bill.
You're the tops. You're the Coliseum. You're the top. You're a Louvre Museum. You're a melody from a symphony by Strauss. You're a Bandel Bonnet, Shakespeare Sonnet. You're Mickey Mouse.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Perotti. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287. CDs and cassettes are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to read a review of the Guinness Book of Me, listen to past shows, or sign up for our weekly newsletter, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from Richard Sandomir of the New York Times, who doesn't have any trouble remembering what ESPN stands for.
Sure, the Entertainment and Sports Programming Network. Yeah, but now the P stands for poker.
Yeah, poker and progress, because if more poker on TV isn't progress, what is? I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
That's faded soon to pop. Buddy, baby, I'm the bottom. You the top. Ba-da-ba-ba-dee-doo-dee-dee.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. From NPR member stations. From the W.K. Kellogg Foundation, from vision to innovative impact, 75 years of philanthropy, on the web at wkkf.org. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.